East, this is Atan Thomas, and you're listening to WPFW Washington, your station for jazz and justice.
Welcome to WPFW Washington at 89.3 FM, WPFWFM.org. This is the Hour of We the People. I'm your host, David Whetstone, and welcome new listeners and regular listeners alike. It's appreciated that listeners like yourselves choose to support this Jazz and Justice radio station for over 48 years. And in this hour, I join my programming colleagues and staff and trying to build better communities, a better world, one broadcast at a time. We'll do that today by focusing in on an important historical figure, Hubert Harrison, a forbidden genius of Black radicalism. Hubert Henry Harrison, born 1883 and passed away 1927, was a journalist, activist, and educator who proposed radical solutions to radical injustices. Crushing poverty, white mob violence, imperial conquests, and world wars were some of his concerns. Harrison was a leading figure in the struggles for socialism, internationalism, free love, free thinking, and free speech. The Harlem Renaissance was his time. However, he has been erased from popular memory. And to help restore our noticing him, our attention to him, and our consideration of him is Dr. Brian Quoba. Dr. Quoba is an associate professor of history and the director of the African and African American Studies program at the University of Memphis. His research centers on political thought and social movements among people of African descent in the United States and across the globe. While completing his doctoral degree at the University of Oxford, he co-founded the Oxford Pan-African Forum and the Roads Must Fall movement to decolonize education at Oxford. Over the past two decades, Dr. Quoba has been an activist on issues including peace building, immigrant workers' rights, socialism, climate justice, Palestine, and the movement for Black lives. Doctor, welcome, welcome, welcome this morning.
Thank you so much for having me, David. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, as I understand it, you have dedicated over a decade, 12 years to be precise, in studying Hubert Henry Harrison. And it's been quite an undertaking. His life offers much as far as I understand it, and as far as how your book which is the title of this show, Hubert Harrison, Forbidden Genius of Black Radicalism, would have us understand. It's an extensive study recently released, and we're going to have you tell us more about this unique person and your work. So like I said earlier, yours has been quite an undertaking. How does your discipline, how does your research, how does your dedication really explain your work and explain Mr. Harrison?
Great question. Well, first off, I want to say also just right off the bat that not only do I have a new book, but I'm coming to the DMV next week for a number of book events. So if your audience really wants to hear more, a more full exposition and actually get copies of the book, I will be at Red Emma's in Baltimore on Saturday, July 26th. I will be at Sankofa Books in Washington, D.C. on Thursday, July 31st. And I will also be at Bus Boys and Poets on 14th and V on Sunday, August 3rd. So if people want more information about that, you know, they can look at my website, briankwoba.com. But yeah, just to get to your question, I mean, Harrison is somebody I've been studying for over a decade now. And, you know, one of the things that is compelling to me or sort of drove my research is this joke that academics sometimes use, right? This idea that research is me-search. In other words, the things that we study are often related to personal things that are personal to us or specific to our lives and our experiences. And, you know, Harrison, I can relate to Harrison's life in a number of ways. The first of which in terms of my journey with Harrison was being in a socialist organization where I first learned about Harrison and the work of Jeff Perry, who, you know, has written the only sort of book length treatments of Harrison until my book. And of course, leaving the socialist organization in part because of its limited racial politics, what we might call white Marxism or white leftism. That's an experience Harrison himself had in the Socialist Party of America a century ago. Because he was a pioneering Black socialist, you know, not only in theory, but in practice. He organized the Colored Socialist Club in Harlem, which was designed to recruit Black workers and organizers into the Socialist Party, where Harrison was based in New York. And eventually the party kind of felt threatened by that and effectively drove him out. And so, you know, this is just one example of another example I can give is Harrison, the time that Harrison was fired for his politics, right? So in 1909, for example, I believe it was, he writes this op-ed in a New York newspaper that was defending some of the Booker T. Washington's critics, including W.E.B. Du Bois, William Monroe Trotter, and others. And Harrison got in some criticisms of his own about how, you know, Booker T. Washington was counseling Black folks not to agitate for political rights or even for the right to vote in the South, and instead to just focus on economic issues. And so Harrison ends up getting fired by one of Booker T. Washington's lieutenants, a guy called Charles Anderson, who was, you know, a fixture in New York Republican politics at that time. And so being fired for his politics, being fired for criticizing Booker T. Washington publicly, becoming a victim of the Tuskegee machine, as Du Bois called it, that's something I experienced when I was teaching high school, because I was doing activism with students, taking them to marches and rallies and protests. And eventually the administration decided not to renew my contract, even though all my previous evaluations had been positive and students were really, I think, interested in learning a lot from the work we were doing, not only inside, but outside the classroom. So I can relate to Harrison's being fired for his politics. I can relate to his experience in and out of a white socialist organization. I can relate to his experience in a lot of other ways. And I think that's why my book is able to sort of lend new insights and new depth to the analysis of Harrison that people may or may not have already had.
Well, this wonderful, and I say this in an odd complimentary way, large forehead, the speckled man, who is from St. Croix, and he makes his way to Manhattan. So, and he does it at a time where we don't understand the immigration from the West Indies to the United States. So tell us more about his origins, if you would.
Absolutely, yeah. So Harrison was born, as you mentioned, on the Caribbean island of St. Croix, what is now the part of the U.S. Virgin Islands with St. Thomas and St. John. Although at that time it was a Danish
Danish.
colony, yeah. And so that's one of the reasons why Harrison spoke and read Danish. But yeah, Harrison, he grew up from he comes from a very humble background. Both his parents were African descended plantation workers. He had a dynamic kind of and very non-nuclear family structure, you might say, because his mother had children by more than one father, and his father had children by more than one mother. So he had really a kind of communal and layers of siblings on all sides, living in the kind of African tradition of it takes a village. And he recalls, for example, the little gardens that they had carved out on their plot, as part of the plantation, where they would grow avocados and soursops and mangoes and things of that nature. And I think those really planted the seeds for his African consciousness, which he would develop much later once he gets to Harlem as a teenager, right? Because his parents ended up dying by the time he was 16 or so. Both his mother and father had passed away. And so he decides at 17 in the year 1900 to move to Manhattan. His sister Mary had already made that transition, as had thousands of Caribbeans in this period, early 20th century, right, migrating to New York, migrating to the US to try to seek better economic opportunities. And this was a massive shift because it took Harrison from a agrarian rural island culture to one of the biggest metropolises in the world at that time, Manhattan, right, which was just full of different communities, different ideas, different technological innovations that would really shape, his worldview and his and provide, I think, an environment where he could really exercise his strengths, in particular ways.
And also, I'm mindful, courtesy through your work, but also other research, that he made his way. His parents and I believe his grandmother found some way of having him get a really high class education in Anglican school before he left St. Croix, if I'm not mistaken. And is it a stretch to also say that somehow he was exposed to the memory of rebellions, resistance by the enslaved.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, as you mentioned, he did have some training in the Anglican Church, and he became a teacher at a school in Friedensfeld, St. Croix, before he made the transition, which speaks to his kind of intellectual acuity, right? To become a teacher as a teenager, at that time was unusual. But in terms of what was the other? Sorry, the second part that you mentioned.
Well, just the being mindful of the history of the
Oh,
rebellions of the enslaved.
right. So there's the Great Fireburn Rebellion in 1878 in St. Croix, which is basically like a general strike of plantation laborers on the island. And Harrison, was not alive in that moment, but his parents certainly. This takes place about 5 years or so before Harrison is born, and so his parents certainly were alive and lived through the Great Fireburn Rebellion. And I often imagine, the ways in which that may have informed the way they raised him, with certain ideas about perhaps the dignity of labor, the violence of colonial exploitation, right, and the plantation system that they were living under in the Caribbean at that time. I think these did plant seeds, and certainly must have had some impact on him via his parents' experience with that massive rebellion on the island.
Well, you said earlier that he made his way to Manhattan, courtesy of his sister, who was ahead of him in that regard, which is not, by the way, an uncommon pattern in West Indian immigration. I need to find out more about that, and I hope other people out there, other listeners, can clue us in. But what is at 17? What is he doing in New York? What is he doing in Manhattan?
Well, at first, like most migrants to the city, he's trying to eke out a living, right? I mean, it's a precarious situation because he had to basically work odd jobs in order to survive. So he works as a bellhop, he works as a messenger, he works as an elevator operator, he works in a fan selling company, basically just to try to make ends meet. Eventually, he after a few years, he's able to secure employment in the post office, and that's a pretty unusual thing for a black immigrant to get a salaried job as a postal clerk. But it's because he passed the aptitude test with such flying colors that they realized there was something unusual about him, and he had a very stellar work record. Until that moment where he writes the
Oh my
op-ed
goodness.
against Washington and, gets fired by the Tuskegee
But
machine.
even before that, while he's working, also he's making his way to advance in education. We should say openly that I don't believe he had much collegiate experience, if at all, but he does something which a lot of, well, quite a few individuals do. He makes a commitment to lifelong learning. And he, like you said, he was noticed. He doesn't escape public notice. Wasn't there a news feature about his outstanding academic abilities?
He goes to he so he goes to night school. He's basically taking classes, at night to try to better his education while working during the day. And yeah, there's an article which remarks on how he passed the final exam like with a perfect score, which no other student had done at that time, which speaks to kind of his rare intellectual gifts and abilities, which we can talk more about in a bit. But also one of the things that he's doing to cultivate that is he's getting education not just in the night school, but also in the lyceums, the public, the sort of debate clubs that exist in a couple of the churches, St. Mark's and St. Benedict's in particular, one Catholic, one AME church. They had these debate clubs, and so he would go and debate with all kinds of people, sort of sharpen his intellectual and oratorical skills. And that's how he met people like Arturo Schomburg, who becomes a key connection for him, somebody who he helps found the Negro Society for Historical Research, which is, basically a kind of Black history focused organization outside the academy, but with powerhouses like Schomburg, who had a massive, collection of books, and John E. Bruce, John Edward Bruce, who was also a bibliophile. And the point being that Harrison, he was very self-taught, right? He was an autodidact and he read everything he could get his hands on, but he also did have mentors and a community of folks with which to engage and sort of refine and hone and shape his ideas. One of my favorite quotes from Harrison is when he was suggesting to the youth how they needed to get education. He said, "Get education not just in school and college, yes, but also in the marketplace, in the barbershop, in social movements, right? In protest organizations. Like, get it everywhere you can, and don't believe you know something until you've tested it against 10 others who know differently and survived the shock." So that's what Harrison was able to do in this moment. He's testing his ideas against multiple other people who know differently and seeing if he can survive the shock.
Allow me to reintroduce you. We're talking to Dr. Brian Kwoba. Dr. Kwoba is an associate professor of history and the director of the African and African American Studies program at the University of Memphis. Our topic is a focus on an important historical figure, Hubert Henry Harrison, forbidden genius of Black radicalism. You're listening to We the People. I'm your host, David Whetstone. And it's a pleasure that you're joining us. So, at this point, what you just described is, I got to say, among even the Black community and maybe New York at large, there's a bustling, kinetic time of change. It's a time of moving out of Reconstruction, racial unrest, but it's a time of modernity. Things are beginning to gel. And Mr. Harrison is recognized not only within the black communities and in a Pan-African sense, too, by the way. Joel Augustus Rogers, J.A. Rogers, popular historian, makes remarks about him. And others. And let's really get down to it. Harrison is known as a true radical, and he's called that by many people. What's the distinction that's trying to be made here? Why is he considered the radical's radical, so to
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, you know, here I can take a lead from the Harlem activist Haj Kiernan, who was a sort of protege and contemporary of Harrison's. And according to Kiernan, as Kiernan saw it, you know, it was Harrison's newspaper, The Voice, which was founded in 1917, that, quote, really crystallized the radicalism of the Negro in New York, unquote. So in other words, Harrison was able to basically draw on a lot of different fields of knowledge to crystallize something that was happening in Black people's consciousness, sort of because of the larger world that they were living in. I mean, for example, you have, you know, the lead up to World War I, and a certain sense of uncertainty mixed with, you know, potent nationalisms in the European world, mixed with
the
migration
States.
Of, and in the United States, right. And the migration of not just Caribbeans to the US, but also Southern African Americans in the so-called Great Migration, moving, you know, to Northern cities like Chicago, Detroit, New York, et cetera. So the context is one where there's a lot of different influences coming in, especially to Harlem, because Harlem becomes really the Black Mecca of this era, right? With Caribbean, Afro-Caribbean migrants, as well as African-American Southern migrants, all streaming in to this, this area in Northern Manhattan, which just creates a very dynamic and vibrant kind of cultural and social life with lots of fraternal organizations and churches and neighborhood associations and ethnic, you know, islander associations for Jamaicans and Barbadians and, you know, St. Lucians and Crucians and everything. And it's in this context that Harrison is able to really kind of get to the root cause. And this is what we mean by radical, right? We don't just mean some crazy or irrational person. We mean someone who's looking at the root causes of injustice, right? Radical having the same root as radish, which is a root vegetable. Looking at the roots of, you know, capitalism, looking at the roots of imperialism, looking at the roots of the Jim Crow white supremacy that shocked Caribbean migrants who were coming to the US, right? If you're coming from Jamaica or St. Croix or Barbados or wherever it might be, and suddenly you're faced now with the reality of lynching, where white mobs are murdering Black people, especially Black men, roughly twice a week in Harrison's day, oftentimes including castration. That shocked a lot of the Caribbean migrants who arrived here because they didn't have the same traditions of white supremacist terrorism and racial violence in the Caribbean that we had in the United States. And so so Harrison, you know, Harrison radicalized in this context, right, where you have massive wealth inequality, the robber barons of the Gilded Age, Rockefeller, Carnegie, J.P. Morgan, making millions and billions of dollars, while, you know, Black folks are literally being roasted alive in the South. That's something that really opened the eyes of people like Harrison and many others. And Harrison was able to kind of synthesize all the ideas and confluence of political and social forces in Harlem to sort of make new organizations, new newspapers, new political breakthroughs that we still have yet to fully appreciate.
Well, he, as you remark, he doesn't, let me put it in the positive, he doesn't consider far afield the capitalistic exploitation of workers, particularly Black workers. It's part of the spectrum, along with the white mob violence and the structured and increasingly institutionalized, if not oppression, discrimination against Black folk. It's very... he's a keen observer of that. And I hope in my talking to you, we can demonstrate the keenness of mine and his courage to speak to what he observes and to share it. Mm-hmm. I'm mindful that we're approaching the halfway point in our show and we've got a lot to cover.
Yeah.
Why don't we start with his crystallization, his affinity for socialism. Mm-hmm. What is pushing or driving him to have great interest in that political philosophy, that political ideology?
Great question. Yeah, so as I mentioned, this is a time when, you know, the robber barons are on the ascendancy, the Rockefellers and J.P. Morgans and Andrew Carnegies of the world, who, you know, have monopolized entire industries, right? The entire oil industry or the entire steel industry or the banking industry. Meanwhile, working class folks are literally being exploited in a very ruthless manner. The steel workers that produced the wealth for Andrew Carnegie, right? The oil workers who produced the wealth for John D. Rockefeller. In the South, you had a lot of convict laborers, people who were literally, you know, basically prison labor, you know, as we still see, unfortunately, going on today. Building railroads, right? Building, serving as timber workers and other kinds of industries.
Or your example of his participation in a protest in the nearby mills outside of, I believe, Newark, New Jersey, or?
Yeah, Patterson. There's in 1913.
In Patterson, excuse me, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's a massive strike of textile workers in Patterson, New Jersey in 1913. Which Harrison joins and is one of the only black figures really at least speaking at these rallies in support of the striking textile workers. These were silk workers because Harrison is himself of the working class. He's of a humble origin. I mentioned his parents were plantation workers. When he gets to New York, he's working odd jobs, you know, as a black immigrant might be expected to do. And so he identifies with working people. He identifies with the struggles that they face against the system. He was part of the postal workers union while he was a postal worker. And he supported, you know, general strikes. In fact, he even supported industrial sabotage, which is one of the things that gets him in trouble with the Socialist Party leaders, right? Because they didn't support the idea that workers might want to literally sabotage the factory equipment and machines as a part of their protest or as a part of their opposition to capitalism. But yeah, I mean, Harrison is he joins the Socialist Party because he sees it as an organization that is fighting for working people and fighting for the liberation of working people from the industrial sort of slavery of capitalism. This idea that you always have to work for a wage or else starve because workers have no, you know, ownership of their own means of production and, you know, basically get subject to the whims of the robber baron capitalists and the employing class rather than anything driven by their own interests.
So he's got a grasp of a larger frame, and I'm going to borrow from the resource you offer us. There's a quote by him: politically, the Negro is the touchstone of the modern democratic idea. The presence of the Negro puts our democracy to the proof and reveals the falsity of it. Now for the challenge within and hanging out with socialist labor causes, he summons his frankness and says that groups have to decide between either Southernism or socialism.
Mm-hmm.
So we're seeing a man who's in his own agency, on his own volition, willing to challenge the status quo.
Absolutely.
So that brings us to our midpoint. Listeners, you're listening to We the People. I'm your host, David Whetstone. Importantly, you're tuned in to WPFW 89.3 FM, WPFWFM.org, Pacifica Foundation Radio, emanating from Washington, D.C., 50,000 watts strong, but stronger still because over 48 years, listeners like you choose to financially support it in its entirety. We're talking about Hubert Henry Harrison, a forbidden genius of Black radicalism, with Dr. Brian Quobaugh, and we'll be back with the good doctor after we bring you some public service announcements. Stay tuned, and we'll finish our conversation shortly.
The Institute for Policy Studies, alongside the Wallace Global Fund, Public Citizen, and The Nation magazine, invite you to their second annual Henry Wallace Symposium, Bold Ideas for a New Progressive Majority, taking place on Thursday, July 17th, from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. at the University of California, Washington Center. Speakers include Representatives Pramila Jayapal, Greg Kassar, and Jamie Raskin, along with Lisa Gilbert of Public Citizen and IPS Executive Director Tope Falerin. That's the second annual Henry Wallace Symposium, Bold Ideas for a New Progressive Majority, on Thursday, July 17th, from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. at the University of California, Washington Center, on 1608 Rhode Island Avenue, Northwest Washington, D.C. More information about how to register can be found online at ips-dc.org/events. WPFW is your station for jazz and justice, building a better world one broadcast at a time.
African Diaspora International Film Festival, Africa World Now Project, and GWU Africana Studies Program present the 18th Annual African Diaspora International Film Festival, D.C., August 1st to the 3rd, featuring a film on Walter Rodney, films on Black musical traditions, and more. Receptions and Q&As, ADIFFDC, from August 1st to the 3rd at the GWU Student Center. Tickets and schedule at nyadiff.org or at 212-864-1760. ADIFF, where Black Life Matters. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
And welcome back to We the People. I'm your host, David Whetstone, right here at WPFW 89.3 FM, WPFWFM.org. And I also thank the listeners in various parts of the world who listen to this show. They've made their presence known to me through the internet. The dulcet tones that you heard announcing the African Diaspora International Film Festival was that of Moise Mutale. He and James Pope present another good reason why to listen to WPFW with their show Africa Now at 1 p.m. on Wednesdays, broadcast terrestrially and available on social media platforms like other programmers do provide. The show deals with African descended people, not only on the continent, but throughout the diaspora, throughout the world, covering politics, history, culture, environment, and a host of other issues. We have Dr. Brian Quobaugh. We're talking about Hubert Henry Harrison, an important activist and leader of the 20th century, who has bequeathed us with many, many gifts and insights, and just an important figure that we need to lift up and recognize and appreciate. Doctor, again, thank you for being with us. I wanted to get you deep into our topic, our person here. Mm-hmm. But I also want to remind listeners that beyond mere biography, you present us what we call an intellectual history. That's mm-hmm. not a pretentious term. That is a way of saying that we're going to present context, analysis, interpretation. Mm-hmm. Because those are the things that really move us along and empower us in the world. Mm-hmm. You wrote, "My interpretations of Harrison's significance have been driven by a number of questions. What can we learn from the various cutting-edge social movements that he joined? What are the hidden corners and connections in his field of vision, and what do they expose? How does Harrison's ideas and political projects relate to those other important figures before, during, and after his time? And what larger local, national, international forces did he amplify or resist?" So what are the lessons from his life experience that we can apply today? Before we conclude the hour, we will try to touch on those things. by talking about his topics of interest. So I'm going to go, I'm going to use a little less words and go a little bit faster with you. You dedicate some time to understanding the influence women and the women's suffrage movement had on Harrison. Just tell us about that. What was that influence?
Yeah, well, one of his, you know, most important influences and mentors was Frances Reynolds Keyser, who was the superintendent of the White Rose Home for basically for Black women migrants to the city. It was a rooming house, a place where they could get, you know, some train, some job skills and some support as new migrants to the city. Part of the larger Black women's club movement that was emerging in this early 20th century, late 19th, early 20th century moment with the National Association of Colored Women. And Harrison, you know, is teaching Black history courses at the White Rose Home. He is managing the boys club. Some of the migrant women would bring their sons or bring children. And he also gets involved in the struggle for Black women's suffrage, because this is a very hot sort of hot button issue in the 1910s, especially the years right before women actually did win the right to vote. Not just white women, but Black women are deeply involved in the discussions about women's suffrage. And Harrison really built on the work of people like Frances Reynolds Keyser. He also built on figures, on the legacy of figures like Ida B. Wells, who, you know, plays such a groundbreaking role in forging a movement to challenge lynching in this country. And Harrison, you know, was able to hear Ida B. Wells speak when she came to New York. He was attending some of the conferences of the Black women's suffragettes and club movement that's going on in this period. And so he's learning a lot from Black women and building on their legacy in ways that is going to be important for his later projects.
And is this the time to talk about? Does it fit in? He formulates a Liberty League of Negro Americans. Is this at the same time?
Yeah, so this is right after he leaves the Socialist Party. You know, before the break, you mentioned this quote from Harrison about the Negro being a touchstone of democracy in the country. In Harrison's case, the Negro also proved to be a touchstone for the Socialist Party, right? Because Harrison tried to get them to take Black workers more seriously, and they basically poo-pooed that. So he leaves the Socialist Party, and ultimately he founds the Liberty League in 1917, which is an independent, Black, you know, founded, Black funded, Black devised organization that's combining African Americans and Afro-Caribbeans in the same organization for the first time, that is talking about an internationalist vision of liberation, supporting oppressed peoples in other countries, and also ending Jim Crow, ending racial violence and the white supremacist system that denied Black folks their, you know, constitutionally, post-Civil War constitutionally protected rights in the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. It was also supporting armed self-defense and a whole number of things. So yeah, the Liberty League is a crucial organization that gives expression to what was called the New Negro movement of the time, right in the middle of World War I, where, you know, Woodrow Wilson, the president at the time, has taken the U.S., decides to take the U.S. into the war, supposedly to make the world safe for democracy. Harrison founds the Liberty League in a direct response to that in order to, as he put it, make the South safe for democracy.
And I'm sure he was well aware of Wilson's hypocrisies, like the screening of Birth of a Nation at the White House.
Yep.
Or subsequently the segregation of federal workforces. Being the keen observer that he was, I'm sure he's mindful of those things.
Yeah, funny story about that is during the war, the Espionage and Sedition Acts made it illegal to dissent from the war. An anti-war speech became, any speaking against the government became illegal. There's a funny line where Harrison says, "I love Wilson as much as I love, well, it would be treason to say it."
So
he trolled the censors here and there when he was able to manage it.
And A clever man indeed. Is this also the time to inquire about two other things? Let's start off with conscious Pan-African frameworks. I suspect this is the period where he, it's in his nature, but he really leans into it, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, it's something that he, so in 1900, just to give an example, in 1906, the Bronx Zoo featured a Congolese man called Otabenga in the monkey house section of the zoo. And so this shows you how much, you know, sort of derogatory and primitivist notions people had of Africans, that you would literally place a living African man in a zoo. Harrison, meanwhile, just next door from the Bronx in Harlem, writes a diary entry, which is a pledge to Mother Africa, where he says, among other things, you know, take at the end of my days, take me to thy bosom, the untamed, untamable African. So Harrison identified from a very early moment, you know, this is his 20s, early 20s, he's identifying as an untamed, untamable African. And when he meets people like Arturo Schomburg and John Edward Bruce, he's able to deepen his African studies and his African consciousness and really apply that and share that with the larger community over time as he becomes such a powerful street corner speaker and orator. And I think, you know, one of the things that's most powerful about his relationship to Africa and African peoples is he decides that, you know, this whole colonial train of thinking that outsiders need to civilize Africans is actually wrong. Harrison says we need to see what Africans have to teach us, because they have much to teach us, right? And that really changed the way people were thinking about things, because even Black folks were oftentimes relating to Africa in a paternalistic way. Mm-hmm. You know, the idea that we have to civilize the Africans, or we have to, you know, there's a tradition of that. And Harrison really rejected that and sort of forged a new way of having respect and humility towards Africa and African peoples, given the vast history of ancient African civilizations, technological achievements, scientific advancements, and so on and so forth that Harrison was able to learn about and study in the Negro Society for Historical Research and other forums.
So he does not keep this knowledge to himself. Right. And here's what's utterly fascinating about this. Mm-hmm. And it's more than just the teaching impulse. Mm-hmm. It's a very deep sense of engagement with the public. And in Harlem, he takes to, I don't want to even call it public teaching or lecturing, but he's outdoors speaking to large crowds. Mm-hmm. And this is a harbinger of an important dynamic to come. Mm-hmm. And it's a harbinger also of, not out of self-interest, but he's really setting himself up in an important place and function. Mm-hmm. What is going on with this sense of really just reaching the masses? Mm-hmm. You've made it clear earlier that it's important that young people and the public at large and everyday people, mm-hmm. You academic sophisticates call it the quotidian experience. Why is this so important, and what's going on with this public speaking that it's so powerful and effective?
Well, Harrison was nothing if not a man of the people, you know, of, by, and for the people. And one of the things that he does to educate folks, because he doesn't have the highfalutin academic titles, right, he's not operating out of a university or a school or something like that. The street was his school. He was the quintessential kind of street scholar, right? Literally getting on stepladders on the corner of 135th Street and Lenox and speaking to audiences that sometimes were large enough to block traffic, right, on the road, because he was such a powerful orator, but he was also so wide in his knowledge. So he spoke about, you know, he spoke about anthropology and sociology. He spoke about English literature, right? He spoke about global geopolitics. He spoke about Black arts and culture.
Technology, I understand he kind of warned us about, if not climate change, the wrongful advances of technology.
Yeah, he had a whole critique of science. He had a critique of, obviously, of Christianity and the church as a Black free thinker. And so I think, you know, one of the ways that he was able to reach and teach people was literally just on the street, because you have to remember there was no internet in the early 20th century. There was no television in the early 20th century. Even radio, you know, there was extremely limited space for Black radio programming in the 1910s. And whatever there was, it was blackface minstrelsy type of programs, right? So the way that people engaged in their social life was literally on the street corners and in these kind of oratorical call and response exchanges, which I called what some residents at the time called the outdoor university. This idea that people would literally go to street corners in Harlem to hear some of the orators, of which Harrison was a pioneer, but certainly not the only one. There were socialists, there were communists, there were Garveyites, there were preachers of different stripes. Right. All in the mix. And this is another key sort of social and community institution that Harrison does so much to cultivate, and which I think people really got most of how people understood Harrison was through those kind of moments. Right. Perhaps even more so than anything that he wrote in the various newspapers and magazines that he wrote for.
Allow me to reintroduce you. We're talking to Brian Quoba, who is an associate professor of history and the director of the African and African American Studies program at the University of Memphis. He's written an important intellectual history called Herbert Harrison, Forbidden Genius of Black Radicalism. We're in our last quarter, as they say in sports and on this show. I'm going to be a little bit more intentional. We've been alluding to a man who's keenly sensitive to world wars, coming from a, frankly, majority white culture and power structure. Mm-hmm. And so we've really briefly alluded to a sense of internationalism. But importantly, you also point out none of these aspects, by the way, of Harrison are disparate. They're kind of integrated in his own mind and spirit.
Yep.
They're somewhat integrated in his presentations to the public. Mm-hmm. But what is it about free thinking and free love that's important? This is, from my understanding, this is not the topics that are always focused upon with Mr. Harrison.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, so Harrison was a free thinker. He identified himself as an agnostic. Basically, the idea that, you know, you follow reason wherever it leads you and don't believe anything that can't really be proven or demonstrated in an empirical or scientific way. So he had a sharp critique of Christianity and the church. He felt like the church exerted a conservative influence in the sphere of ideas in Black communities, especially. And he had a critique of religion more generally. But I think part of what he was able to do with that is to sort of apply a more critical lens towards the regime that we might call compulsory monogamy, right? This idea that the only legal and legible and respectable form of romantic relationship is to have a maximum of one romantic or sexual partner at a time. There's a free love movement that exists at this time that Harrison is learning from and ends up becoming a part of by connecting capitalism and white supremacy and colonialism to compulsory monogamy, and looking at the history of sexuality, that it changes over time in different, you know, places and cultures.
Well, he's also coming out of and living in a time of great sexual violence. I mean, that's what's associated with lynchings and rapes of Black men and women, of mistreatment of queer folk, which is a very important presence during the Harlem Renaissance and in Harlem. He's mindful of all that. Mm-hmm. And for listeners who might think all these things are wide and widespread, he thought that sex education and contraception and those things were equally important. Sorry, I don't want to take away from anything you might offer.
No, that's a great cue, because I was just going to say, for people to understand this really simply, Harrison was the first Black figure in U.S. history, as far as I can tell, the first Black voice to, number one, agitate for decriminalizing access to contraception, number two, to denounce church and state repression of sexuality, number three, to offer a public-facing course on sex education, and number four, to defend free love on the grounds, in part, that we are not monogamous by nature, as he put it. I think this is a really fascinating aspect of Harrison's legacy, because it's something that even to this day, we still haven't quite grappled with. You know, we have systemic critiques of capitalism and imperialism and white supremacy and even maybe heteronormativity in some cases, but monogamy and the compulsion towards monogamy, or seeing monogamy as something that is not natural to us but imposed by coercion from church and state and capital, that I think remains a sort of very new idea in some ways, or something that, you know, hasn't yet been fully explored, because it actually has quite profound implications for our personal lives, our romantic and sexual lives, and the family structure, and all kinds of things.
Well, we're leaving, hopefully, one of the most many interesting aspects for last. We mentioned the Liberty League of Negro Americans that he formulated.
Mm-hmm.
We mentioned the fact that, or I didn't mention, or help you mention the fact that, you know, he was a prolific writer. You know, he appeared in, I believe, the Nation, the New York Times, literary magazines, both Black and white.
Yep.
All these things rolled together to give tremendous structure and influence on Marcus Garvey and the UNIA.
Yep.
Unfair to you, but we have about 3 minutes to work with.
Okay.
What was his impact and influence on Marcus Garvey and UNIA?
Well, to put it simply, Hubert Henry Harrison was simultaneously Marcus Garvey's greatest catalyst and also his gravest critic. Garvey joins Harrison's Liberty League when he gets to New York, and it totally reshapes Garvey's vision of what's possible and or even desirable. Prior to that, Garvey wanted a Tuskegee-style institute in Jamaica. After the Liberty League experience, Garvey's talking about a race-first internationalist movement with a tricolor flag, for Black communities all over. And so those are elements that he took and learned from the Liberty League. Harrison ends up joining Garvey's movement as editor of Garvey's newspaper, The Negro World. And Harrison, in that capacity, after kind of stimulating the rise of Garvey and Garveyism through the Liberty League, Harrison is now seeing Garvey in a more critical light. And so, because he's working with him up close, you know, and seeing how he's leading the UNIA, and Harrison develops this very sharp critique of some of Garvey's proclivities when it comes to his authoritarian behavior, for example, right? Having a very top-down HNIC model of, you know, organization. Harrison was a labor radical, and, you know, that was a tough thing for him to stomach. And so at the end of the day, Harrison develops this critique of Garvey, which I think hasn't really been heard or hasn't really been fully understood, and is very powerful precisely because it's coming from within. It's not an outsider like a Du Bois or a Cyril Briggs or somebody who's outside the UNIA critiquing Garvey from the outside. This is from within the UNIA, from within a leadership role as Negro World Editor, that Harrison is developing this critique. And so I think both sides, I try to honor in the book both sides of that, right? Harrison's role in stimulating Garveyism, but also his important critique that he develops of Marcus Garvey.
We just have a minute of close here for additional content. We talked and began the show that saying Harrison was erased. He pushes with innovation. He redefines things, even the term the New Negro, which came about right after Reconstruction, was capitalized on by Alain Locke in the Harlem Renaissance. Why is he forgotten? Here's a great man. What you've said in this hour, and for man alone, the great man theory leading change.
Yeah, well, Harrison was forgotten. Harrison was forgotten basically because he was too, he created too much cognitive dissonance for the organizations that he played a role in. So the Socialist Party, you know, basically drove him out. They didn't want to remember him. The Garvey movement, although he stimulated it, he critiqued them. They didn't want to remember him. So nobody wanted to remember him because his critique was too sharp. And I'll just finish by saying again, I'm going to be at Red Emma's July 26th to talk about the book, Sankofa Books on July 31st, and also Busboys and Poets at 14th and V on August 3rd. So if folks want more information, please check out my website, briankwoba.com. That's briankwoba.com.
And good doctor, thank you for being with us. Again, your book is Hubert Harrison, Forbidden Genius of Black Radicalism. Coming up next, Don't Forget the Blues with Clarence the Blues Man Turner. My thanks to Mike Nassel, our engineer, and to you, the listeners, for tuning in and supporting WPFW. Take good care.
Hello, WPFW listeners. Summertime is here. Words, Beats, and Life has the event for your family and friends this season. The second annual DMV Made Festival is happening Saturday, July 26th on the National Mall, a one-day celebration of the D.C., Maryland, Virginia region, promoting the intersections of arts and culture, plus health and wellness. With live music by Go-Go Legends, EU, featuring Sugar Bear, vocalist Navasha Deya, jazz fusion trio The Mastetics, Black Folks Don't Swim, Kamau, and much more. Plus Family Fun Zone, Poetry and Storytelling Pavilion, Interactive Dance Stage, Live Art Installations, Hands-On Workshops, and Health and Wellness Pavilion. July 26th on the National Mall. Full details at wblinc.org/DMVMade. See you there. Brought to you by Words, Beats, and Life with support from WPFW.
African Diaspora International Film Festival, Africa World Now Project, and GWU Africana Studies Program present the 18th Annual African Diaspora International Film Festival DC, August 1st to the 3rd, featuring a film on Walter Rodney, films on Black musical traditions, and more. Receptions and Q&As, ADIFFDC, from August 1st to the 3rd at the GWU Student Center. Tickets and schedule at nyadiff.org or at 212-864-1760. ADIFF, where Black Life Matters. WPFW, building a better world one broadcast at a time.
Hi, this is Jim Byers, host of the Latin Flavor Classic Edition. For nearly 5 decades, support from listeners like you has kept WPFW's wheels rolling. In fact, the single largest category of donations comes from those who donate an unused car to the station. That's right, running or not. Even a car sitting idle that needs thousands of dollars in repairs can do wonders for WPFW. If you can't drive it, donate it. WPFW will get the proceeds, and you'll get a tax break. Go to WPFWFM.org or call 1-866-WPFW-CAR. That's 1-866-973-9227 for more information. Help WPFW continue building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
The Institute for Policy Studies, alongside the Wallace Global Fund, Public Citizen, and The Nation magazine, invite you to their second annual Henry Wallace Symposium, Bold Ideas for a New Progressive Majority, taking place on Thursday, July 17th, from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. at the University of California, Washington Center. Speakers include Representatives Pramila Jayapal, Greg Kassar, and Jamie Raskin, along with Lisa Gilbert of Public Citizen and IPS Executive Director Tope Falerin. That's the second annual Henry Wallace Symposium, Bold Ideas for a New Progressive Majority, on Thursday, July 17th, from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. at the University of California, Washington Center, on 1608 Rhode Island Avenue, Northwest Washington, D.C. More information about how to register can be found online at ips-dc.org/events. WPFW is your station for jazz and justice, building a better world one broadcast at a time. Still
good bet the best is yet to come.
Hi, this is Robin Holden.